Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear reports from Mario Ritter and Kelly Jean Kelly. Anna Mateo has this week's health and lifestyle report. We end our program with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, Chinese Navy ships and Russian submarines are now traveling in North Atlantic waters at a pace not seen since the end of the Cold War. The United States Navy's top admiral made the statement to VOA. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson said China's Navy is competing with the United States. He said it is ready and capable of operating anywhere. He added, "Even 5 years ago, we wouldn't have seen anything like this." However, Chinese operations may not be considered as threatening as the growing activity of Russian submarines. U.S. officials worry that Russia may use its submarines to cut or listen to undersea communication links that connect North America and Europe. "We are talking about more than we've seen in 25 years," Richardson said. Because of these activities, the United States has recently reactivated the Second Fleet to secure the ocean on its eastern coast. The group of ships was deactivated in 2011 because the U.S. Navy needed money to buy weapons systems. The group was reactivated in the port city of Norfolk, Virginia, on July 1st. Richardson will preside over the official ceremony to reactivate the fleet on August 24th. The commander of the Second Fleet will also head NATO's Joint Forces Command in Norfolk. Richardson said the dual command structure permits the U.S. and its NATO allies to deal with the rising Russian activity together. Richardson said the U.S. must also stay ahead in the competitive area of information warfare. U.S. sailors are now defending themselves against Russian electronic interference devices. The devices are similar to ones used against American ground forces operating in Syria. Richardson did not say how the interference, or jamming, affects the Navy. But electronic warfare attacks could interfere with navigation and communication systems.
Japanese high school students have created a virtual reality program to mark the 73rd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. The American bombing on August 6, 1945, along with the bombing of Nagasaki 3 days later, ended World War II. The first attack killed an estimated 140,000 people. The students produced a 5-minute program that recreates the sights and sounds of Hiroshima before, during, and after the bombing. Their project took 2 years to complete. The students and their teachers undertook the effort in hopes that such an event will never happen again. In order to experience the program, users wear virtual reality headsets. The program lets them take a virtual walk along the Motoyasu River before the bombing. It shows the buildings and businesses that once stood. Users also can enter a post office and the Shima Hospital courtyard. The bomb exploded directly above the hospital, completely destroying it. They can see the remains of a building now called the Atomic Bomb Dome. The program shows the sunny summer day in 1945. Cicada insects sing in the trees. Later, a single plane flies overhead. Then, a flash of light, followed by a huge explosion. Buildings are gone in a moment. Smoke and fires spread under the darkened sky. Some of the students said virtual reality technology was a good choice to reach their goal. The students who worked on the project belong to a computer skills research club at Fukuyama Technical High School. Fukuyama is a city about 100 kilometers from Hiroshima. Mei Okada said of the virtual reality project, "Even without language, once you see the images, you understand." To recreate Hiroshima before the bombing, students studied photographs and spoke to survivors. Then, they used software to add realistic details to the virtual reality program. Those who knew the city very well tell us it's done very well. They say it's very nostalgic, said Katsushi Hasegawa. Hasegawa is a computer teacher who supervises the club. He said, "Seeing the effect of people remembering the past makes me glad we created this." I'm Mario Ritter.
In the U.S. this month, Americans are discussing whether 3D guns are legal. Cody Wilson says yes. He first used a website to publish designs for a printable handgun in 2013. But the U.S. State Department soon ordered him to stop, saying the designs violated laws related to exports. This summer, the two parties reached a settlement that would permit Wilson to publish the designs. But when public officials warned that 3D guns threatened public safety, a judge blocked Wilson until the issue could be discussed again. Wilson calls his argument a First Amendment case. The First Amendment, part of the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights, permits Americans the right to most kinds of speech. Wilson believes it permits him to share the plans to make a gun with a 3D printer. His lawyer, Josh Blackman, said, "This is a very, very, very easy First Amendment question that I think people might be hesitant to accept because it involves guns, and people don't like guns." The federal judge, who has temporarily blocked Wilson, noted the case presented serious First Amendment issues. But Judge Robert Lasnik also said that guns made on 3D printers could create serious harm. Critics of 3D guns say criminals or terrorists could easily create the guns and hide them. The New York Times newspaper notes they can be printed without serial numbers or government regulations. In addition, all plastic guns would violate a 1988 law called the Undetectable Firearms Act. That act outlaws guns that cannot be identified by a metal detector. Congress has renewed the act several times, and it remains in effect. Even though Wilson's designs call for some metal, critics say a user could easily remove those pieces. It's an absurdity. You can take the piece of metal out and put it back in at your own whims, and you can take it out and walk through a metal detector undetected, said Jonas Oransky, legal director for the group Everytown for Gun Safety. Wilson answers that he is not making an all-plastic gun. He is simply providing the information on how someone could make one. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Traditional wedding vows often include the promise to be by your spouse's side in sickness and in health, till death do you part, or something similar. Well, if you are in a bad marriage, the death part may come sooner than expected.
A new study finds that a stressful marriage may be unhealthy, especially for men. In fact, for some people, it may be as bad as smoking.
This finding seems to be opposite of many other studies that say marriage improves health. For example, one British study found that being married improved a person's chances of surviving a heart attack. The researchers said married people had shorter hospital stays.
And experts at Harvard Medical School write on their website that married people live longer, have fewer strokes and heart attacks, have a lower chance of becoming depressed, are less likely to have advanced cancer at the time of diagnosis, and more likely to survive cancer for a longer period of time, and survive a major operation more often.
One way to make sense of conflicting findings about marriage is to consider the quality of the relationship. Do the partners support each other, or do they give each other long-term chronic stress? To find out how bad a stressful marriage is on health, researchers at two universities in the United States, the University of Nevada, Reno, and the University of Michigan, teamed up. They followed 373 couples for 16 years.
The researchers wanted to know if often conflicting over certain topics affected a person's health in a negative way. These topics included such things as children, money, in-laws, and recreational activities. They found a conflict-filled relationship harms the body in many ways. People in a stressful relationship can have damaging inflammation, extreme changes in appetite, and increased levels of stress hormones. All these conditions can negatively affect many systems, from heart function to how the body is able to fight diseases. The researchers also found that a bad marriage was harder on men's health than on women's.
A good marriage is not without arguments, stress, and disagreements. What seems to matter most is how a couple speaks to each other, How do they handle their differences? How do they resolve an argument? One of the lead researchers is Rosie Schrout with the University of Nevada, Reno. In an interview with The Guardian, Schrout says conflict can be particularly damaging for health if spouses are hostile or defensive during disagreements. She adds that arguing about the same topic over and over again without finding a solution can also damage a person's health.
Schrout also spoke with The Guardian about the health benefits of marriage. She said the act of getting married does not make people healthier. Instead, she said, the support married people give each other can help them stay healthier, heal faster, and have better mental well-being.
On the website Women's Health, relationship experts and happy couples give their tips on how to keep a relationship healthy. Here are a few.
Stop keeping score. A healthy relationship is not about winning and losing. In the bigger picture, who made the most money or who emptied the dishwasher last is not important.
Touch more. It does not have to be sexual touching. Simply holding hands can create stronger feelings between people. But now that we're on the subject, relationship experts claim that having more sex does help a couple stay close.
Accept your in-laws. No family is perfect. Experts warn against complaining about your partner's family or trying to change them. Having a sense of humor is often the best approach.
Turn off social media, stop texting, hide your phone, and just hang out. Turning off social media and technology gives a couple the space to just be themselves. Playing a game, cooking a meal, or taking a walk allows a couple to have simple fun together.
Learn how to fight fairly. Even couples in healthy relationships disagree. A relationship expert suggests that understanding how the other person deals with conflict can help a marriage in a big way. And don't be afraid of losing a fight. Remember the earlier tip about not keeping score.
And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin this story on January 20th, 1961, the day John Fitzgerald Kennedy became President of the United States. It had snowed heavily the night before. Few cars were in the streets of Washington. The outgoing president, Dwight Eisenhower, was 70 years old. John Kennedy was just 43. He was the first American president born in the 20th century. Both Eisenhower and Kennedy served in World War II. Eisenhower had been commander of Allied forces in Europe. Kennedy had been a young Navy officer in the Pacific. He came from a politically influential family in Boston, Massachusetts, but he was a fresh face in national politics. To millions of Americans, he represented a chance for a new beginning.
Not everyone liked him, however. Many people thought he was too young to be president. Others did not like the idea of electing the nation's first Roman Catholic president. Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, ran against Kennedy in the election of 1960. Many people believed Nixon was a stronger opponent of communism than Kennedy. The election of 1960 was one of the closest in American history. Kennedy defeated Nixon by fewer than 120,000 votes. Now, on the steps of the Capitol building, he would be sworn in as the nation's 35th president. One of the speakers at the inauguration was the 86-year-old poet Robert Frost. The wind was blowing the paper in his hands, and the sun was shining off the snow on the ground and into his eyes. Kennedy stood to help him, but the famous poet was unable to read much of the poem he had written specially for the ceremony. Instead, he began another one that he knew from memory. Here is a studio recording of Robert Frost reading his poem, The Gift Outright.
The land was ours before we were the lands. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's. Still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war, to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become.
Soon it was time for the new president to speak. He was not wearing a winter coat or a hat, unlike many of the people around him. One of the issues that Kennedy talked about was the danger of what he called the deadly atom. He was taking office during the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. Both sides had atomic bombs. People worried that there could be a World War III that would end in nuclear destruction. Kennedy said, both sides should make serious proposals for the inspection and control of nuclear weapons. He said they should explore the good in science instead of the terrors.
Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just, and the weak secure, and the peace preserved.
Kennedy also spoke about a torch of leadership being passed to a new generation of Americans. He urged young people to take the torch and accept responsibility for the future. He also urged other countries to work with the United States to create a better world.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
John Kennedy was in office less than 2 weeks when the Soviet Union released 2 American airmen. The Soviets had shot down their spy plane over the Bering Sea. About 60 million people watched as Kennedy announced the airmen's release. It was the first presidential news conference broadcast live on television in the United States. Kennedy welcomed the release as a step toward better relations with the Soviet Union. The next month, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev made another move toward better relations. He sent Kennedy a message. The message said that disarmament would be a great joy for all people on Earth. A few weeks later, President Kennedy announced the creation of the Peace Corps. He had spoken about his idea during the election campaign. The Peace Corps would send thousands of Americans to developing countries to teach and provide technical assistance. Soon after the Peace Corps was created, another program was announced. The purpose of the Alliance for Progress was to provide economic aid for 10 years to nations in Latin America. Another subject that Kennedy had talked about during the election campaign was the space program. He believed the United States should continue to explore outer space. The Soviet Union had gotten there first. It launched the world's first satellite in 1957. Then, in April 1961, the Soviet Union sent the first manned spacecraft into orbit around Earth. That same month, the new American president suffered a foreign policy failure. On April 17th, more than 1,000 Cuban exiles landed on a beach in western Cuba. They had received training and equipment from the United States Central Intelligence Agency. They were supposed to lead a revolution to overthrow the communist government of Fidel Castro. The place where they landed was Bahia de Cochinos, the Bay of Pigs. The invasion failed. Most of the exiles were killed or captured. It was not Kennedy's idea to try to start a revolution in Cuba. Officials in the last administration of Dwight Eisenhower had planned it. However, most of Kennedy's advisors supported the idea, and he approved it. In public, the president said he was responsible for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. In private, he said, "All my life, I've known better than to depend on the experts. How could I have been so stupid?" What happened in Cuba damaged John Kennedy's popularity. His next months in office would be a struggle to regain the support of the people.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for more stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.